Let's hear now from teachers who are having trouble pursuing their chosen career. An estimated 250,000 educators face layoffs in the coming year as states cut school funding to balance budgets. That number comes from the American Association of School Administrators. And many teachers name job uncertainty as one of the biggest downsides of the profession. NPR's Larry Abramson spent time with two teachers here in Los Angeles who are worried about their next paycheck.
At Graham Elementary School in South Los Angeles, drama teacher Misty Monroe gets to see students during a rare moment in their day. When she's teaching them, they aren't angsting over some high-stakes test.
Today, let's have you line up like pirates.
Misty Monroe is an itinerant drama teacher. Every day, she visits a different L.A. school and brings a little art into kids' lives. Despite 8 years with the L.A. Unified School District, Monroe has gotten an unwelcome present at the end of this year, a layoff notice.
This will be my second year.
Many school districts are required to send out layoff notices in the spring, even if they think they will rehire workers. Many teachers are recalled over the summer. That's what happened to Misty Monroe last year. But she says the suspense of having unemployment hanging over your head is unnerving.
The sad part is that morale dips so drastically once the pink slips go out, because the worry begins about family, mortgage, and stuff like that.
Whether the cause is budget cuts or shrinking enrollment, some teachers face this prospect year after year. Despite all the hubbub about union contracts and how tough it is to fire bad teachers, junior teachers have little protection against the layoff acts. Just ask Roya Prudhomme. After 4 years with the Los Angeles Unified School District, Prudhomme gets the same letter every spring.
For the past 3 years, I've gotten a pink slip every single year.
At her apartment in downtown Los Angeles, Roya Prudhomme pulls out this year's personal communication from the school district.
As you may be aware, the Los Angeles Unified School District continues to face a dire financial situation. While the district hopes that solutions may be found to mitigate this crisis, it is with sincere regret that I must send you this letter at this time.
Getting a job at the Miguel Contreras Learning Complex was the fulfillment of a dream. Prudhomme teaches English here. It's a big urban high school full of mostly low-income students, just the population she wants to serve. Her supervisor here, Nova Mesa, says it's just a bad time.
You can't blame the district. You can't blame, I guess, the schools necessarily. I just feel like education in the state of California is in dire straits.
Many blame state laws and union contracts that say teachers must be laid off according to seniority. But many teachers I spoke with say ending seniority rights just isn't the answer. That would just make them feel more insecure. In addition to teaching sophomore English, Prudhomme runs what's known as an advisory, a group of students who stay with her throughout high school. Junior Jackie Vasquez came to a park near downtown to talk about the fate of her favorite teacher. Vasquez says she has struggled in high school, but Prudhomme stayed on her.
She's always asking me, how am I doing, how are my other classes? She always pushes me.
You need that.
Yeah, I do. Because I just tend to slack off and not care.
Prudhomme took Jackie and some other students on a college tour of Northern California last year at her own expense. They will be among the first in their families to go to college. Jackie knows that getting into the University of California at Berkeley would be a reach for her, but she is jazzed by the prospect.
Berkeley, wow. Well, Berkeley was a beautiful place, like a place where it was very liberal. You know, you could be whatever you want, you could do whatever you want, and you're not going to be judged.
Roya Prudhomme could search for jobs in other districts, but all of them are facing budget pressures, and she'd have to give up what little seniority she has. Charter schools are another option she's considering. But for now, she's stuck on her school and on the kids here and doesn't want to leave. So until school ends later this month...
I teach as though I don't have a pink slip. I teach as though I'll be teaching forever.
Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're getting a little closer to the time when the U.S. government could default on its debt. President Obama's administration is still talking with Republicans in search of a budget deal and an agreement to raise the federal debt limit that would solve the short-term issue by keeping the government running as normal. But even as those talks continue, some leading economic voices say there is a longer-term problem. It's the question of how to eventually bring down the federal government's massive borrowing. NPR's Andrea Seabrook was in the room yesterday for a meeting where experts argued the fiscal situation is worse than you think.
If you shake the economic eight ball today, this answer will float to the top. Outlook, not so good. The annual conference of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget showed its gravitas from the start, a rare statement from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke.
Perhaps the most important thing for people to understand about the federal budget is that maintaining the status quo is not an option.
No one, said Bernanke, will lend money to a government with endlessly rising debt and stagnant income. Vast change is imperative. Bernanke said this change
could take place through a careful and deliberative process that weighs priorities and gives individuals and firms adequate time to adjust to changes in government programs and tax policies.
Sound like our current government to you? Not to anybody at the conference either. But if Washington waits for a crisis to start fixing things, says Bernanke, it will be much more painful with rising interest rates, collapsing confidence, and possibly another economic slowdown. If that's too wonky an explanation for you, try this.
Here's where we are. If you spend more than you earn, you lose your butt. And if you spend a buck and borrow 41 cents, you gotta be stupid.
That's Alan Simpson, a former Republican senator and one of the co-chairs of the recent Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. The Simpson-Bowles Report, as it's called, was the first comprehensive fiscal plan for the U.S. government to be put on the table. And negotiating it, says Simpson, was agonizing.
This is a stink bomb in the garden party.
What America faces, said Simpson, is the erosion of the economy, a lower standard of living for adults now and for their children later. So the commission put forth a broad and bold plan, which includes tax increases, spending cuts, and erasing all tax deductions for businesses and banks, for homeowners and parents.
We have felt that we have achieved an astounding success. We have effectively pissed off everybody in America.
A more partisan speech came from House Republican Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan.
To govern is to actually put an idea on the table, and that's precisely what we did in the House of Representatives.
The Ryan budget fundamentally changes Medicare and Medicaid without raising any taxes. Every Democrat voted nay, and all but four House Republicans voted yay, which led this Democrat to announce,
I'm mystified by the conversation that's going on in Washington. Mystified.
Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, the budget problem is sweeping and universal. Yet Washington is still engaged in tooth and claw partisanship. Bennett says for many Americans, this debate will test whether government can work at all.
They want to know that we're all in it together. So this Washington language that's pitting one group against another group is of no interest. They want to know that we all have something to contribute to solving the problem. And they want it emphatically to be bipartisan.
There was one thing everyone agreed on. The fiscal situation is bad. Really bad. Not just, oh yeah, the budget, it's always messed up. More like, wake up. The country is in danger. If politicians can get it together, the solution won't be pretty either. So these budget heavyweights warned, Americans, brace yourselves. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
Some other news. In Greece today, a nationwide strike over new government austerity measures sparked riots in Athens. The financial crisis forced the country's prime minister into talks about stepping down to make way for a national unity government. The European Union and the International Monetary Fund, you'll recall, bailed out Greece about a year ago, but the country is still heading toward default on its debts. European leaders are now considering a second bailout, but they want more sacrifices from Greece. Many Greeks say a year of painful budget cuts and tax hikes have done little to reduce their country's debts. From Athens, Joanna Kakissis reports.
For the last 3 weeks, Syndagma Square has become a gathering place for Greeks fed up with austerity. Inspired by Spain's indignados, protesters here have pitched tents across the street from Parliament. Every night, someone gives an anti-austerity speech. People paint protest banners and play drums. Georgia Nikopoulou says the protest has given many despairing Greeks some hope. She's a 28-year-old marine biologist who speaks four languages but can only find work at a shop. Because business is bad, she says she hasn't gotten paid since January. Many of her friends have given up, she says.
Most of them have left the country. goes, there's no future for us here.
Polls show that Greeks have lost faith in the ruling socialist. State-run Net TV reported today that Prime Minister George Papandreou is in power-sharing talks with Adonis Samaras, the leader of the main opposition New Democracy Party. Net said that Papandreou and Samaras are discussing who would be the new prime minister under a coalition government and how the new government would change austerity policies. Protesters formed a human chain around Parliament today to prevent lawmakers from making any more austerity cuts. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
With unemployment high and rising, it's hard to believe that U.S. employers are actually having trouble filling jobs. But a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal insists they are. One of the article's authors is Jeffrey Immelt, who's President Obama's job czar. He's the CEO and chair of GE. And the article says, in part, there are more than 2 million open jobs in the U.S., in part because employers can't find workers with the advanced manufacturing skills they need. Well, that got us wondering, what and where are these jobs? And for answers, we turn out to Tony Carnevale, who is director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First of all, what can you tell us about these jobs?
They tend to be jobs that in the old days, 20, 25 years ago, people learned on the job. You'd hire on the loading dock and work your way up to all kinds of different occupations, technical jobs, running machines, even accountant and ultimately CEO. But employers no longer do training to qualify workers. They're happy to train workers that are qualified. So we have a shortage of workers in can-do jobs. Simply taking a person with a strong back and a good work ethic and throwing them at modern manufacturing machinery will result in a disaster.
But, you know, one thing that just sounds wrong about the 2 million jobs that are a result of a mismatch, they're open because of a mismatch, that would make a lot more sense if there were 6 or 7 million Americans who were unemployed or underemployed. But with 15 million people, at least in that condition, it seems as though, unless you're in a depopulated area, you'd be able to find somebody with the skills that are needed for these jobs.
Make no mistake. The American problem at the moment is there are too many people looking for work and not enough jobs. But it is also the case that underneath that huge wave of negative job statistics, there is a structural problem in our ability to match people and their skills to the jobs that are available.
There is a counter argument here, which is that when the housing bubble burst, millions of Americans didn't lose their skills. They lost their money, and they lost their buying power, and the economy slowed down. And that's really what we have to do to get jobs going.
In the United States, manufacturing is still the number one industry. It has the highest level of output. Unfortunately, it's the fourth largest employer now, largely because of productivity increases, not because the jobs went overseas. But what's changed is that the manufacturing jobs of today require much higher skill levels than the manufacturing jobs of yesterday. People don't just come to work and run one machine. They run several machines and work with each other.
Recently, I witnessed one of Mr. Immelt's recommendations to solve the mismatch problem at work. I was in Southern Virginia at a community college. Local manufacturing employers have relationships with the community college. They learn, the teachers there learn what skills have to be imparted. The community college trains workers for them. Can that be an adequate substitute for vocational secondary education or for an apprenticeship program?
In the United States, we don't really have vocational secondary programs. We've essentially built our high school system to prepare everybody to go to college, and in the process left lots of people behind. So we need to build direct relationships between employers and community colleges, and I would argue high schools as well.
Thinking back to the days when we used to have vocational high schools, one reason we don't was the notion that there's something undemocratic about tracking kids away from the prospect of a college education when they are 14 years old or whatever age that choice might be made. How do we address that problem?
Underneath this mismatch problem is a moral dilemma. If we decide that we're going to train people for vocations, especially vocations that don't require a four-year college, we'll quickly find that the kids who are available for that are black, Hispanic, or low income. And so we'll end up tracking. We can, if we want to, make people better off, but if we stick to the purity of our ideals, which is that everybody goes to college and gets a four-year degree, we're not going to be able to get there.
Well, Tony Carnevale, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Tony Carnevale is the director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce.